It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Chuck Cooper was the Duquesne University basketball star and Pittsburgh native who became the first African-American drafted by an NBA team when he was selected in the second round by the Boston Celtics on April 29, 1950. In 2011, the Chuck Cooper Foundation was established in tribute to his legacy. The foundation presents its annual Leadership, Diversity, and Community Service Award this week. And on Saturday, Duquesne will host Dayton in the annual Chuck Cooper Classic. Joining us in Studio A to discuss the legacy of Chuck Cooper is his son, Chuck Cooper III. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you have a comment or question, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Also, if you have a Chuck Cooper story you'd like to share, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Chuck Cooper III, your father has been called the Jackie Robinson of pro basketball, and yet the part he played in breaking the color barrier in the NBA doesn't seem to get the same notoriety as the integration of other sports and professions in America. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, you got to remember that when Jackie came into Major League Baseball, baseball was the American pastime at that time. Basketball was a little bit more of a sideshow. So it certainly didn't have the American fanfare, didn't get the attention that him breaking the color barrier in professional basketball did when Jackie came into Major League Baseball. And he also gave Jackie Robinson a lot of credit for making things easier.
He did.
Yes, he did.
I suppose that, you know, Jackie Robinson was the first in more ways than one because he was the first in any of the pro sports to break the color barrier. Your dad grew up in Pittsburgh. He attended Westinghouse High School. How did he develop his skills growing up?
Mellon Park, which is where a lot of Pittsburghers, including myself, developed our skills. But Mellon Park in East Liberty was a popular playground. The best ball players in the city traditionally over years have gathered there to showcase their skills. And back in his era, he played with Dick Groat and some other great players. What a lot of people don't know that my father had two proteges that actually made it into the NBA, Maurice Stokes and also Ed Fleming. And Maurice Stokes was, in my dad's estimation, the greatest player who ever lived. And unfortunately, he got injured during his career, didn't get a chance to really prove that. But he certainly was the rookie of the year and was really the first Magic Johnson-type basketball player in the NBA. And again, he was my dad's protege. When my dad was playing professional ball, he would let Maurice Stokes and Ed Fleming actually use his car. He had purchased a pretty nice car back in that time. And so those were his two proteges. But and they also played at Mellon Park.
Boy, I'm just picturing someone like your father, Chuck Cooper, going up against Dick Groat way back when. And those must have been just some classic games. I can see why it was the survival of the fittest on those courts, right?
Well, Dick Groat had his crew, and, they were some pretty good ball players. And I was talking to Ed Fleming once before Mr. Fleming passed away. And Dick remembers beating Ed Fleming and his crew a few times, but Ed doesn't remember it that way. But I imagine that you're right that they were some pretty heated competitions and certainly some tremendous ballplayers in that time period.
What is it about East Liberty? Gene Kelly, Chuck Cooper, Dick Groat was from, near there.
Switzville, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's something in the water.
Well, I think it's kind of just a central point in Pittsburgh. It's easy to get to. I'm glad to see he's being revitalized. And we played at Reisenstein and Mellon Park, so we had an option. So if the one court was crowded, we could go to another. So it's just always been a great place to kind of hang out, and with this recent development, it's going to continue to be.
Before we get to your dad entering the Lily White NBA in 1950, what was it like for him at Duquesne in the 1940s?
Duquesne was interesting. My understanding was, they played at the old Boston Garden, which was a hockey arena. And I remember him telling me stories about just how cold it was, playing over there. They didn't have the technology that they do nowadays, so just wet and cold. But
they put that parquet floor, the famous parquet floor in the garden, over the ice. And I guess Bill Russell to this day says that's did a number on his ankles,
just right.
Playing on that cold hard wood.
Right. And I was referring actually to the Duquesne Garden, though.
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah, that's where he played at Duquesne University. But, you know, he really
– Right, because they had a hockey – they had the Pittsburgh Hornets hockey team.
That's right. That's right. But he really had a tremendous amount of respect for Duquesne University. Back in the early – the late 40s, the University of Tennessee came to play against Duquesne. And they refused to play if Duquesne let my father play. And Duquesne sent the University of Tennessee home without a game. So I think that's what really forged the relationship between my dad and the university, and he worked very, very hard on their behalf up until he passed away.
Duquesne University made a stand.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. He was extremely proud and honored that they took that approach. I mean, it was a unanimous vote. They said, hey, we're not going to play. If Chuck can't play, we won't play. And I always tease Greg Amodio, the current AD at Duquesne. I said, you know, the University of Tennessee owes us a game. The game was never played. So we're working on that.
We're talking with Chuck Cooper III here on Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking about his dad, Charles Chuck Cooper, the Pittsburgh native who became the first African-American player drafted by an NBA team. And basketball in the 1940s, early 50s, if you wanted to play professionally as an African-American, what were the opportunities that you had and what were the opportunities available to your father?
Great question. Not many. Not many, that's for sure. You know, the New York Rens had a team that was pretty popular back in the day. And then the Harlem Globetrotters, which he was actually under contract with the Globetrotters when he got drafted by the Boston Celtics. And Abe Saperstein, the owner of the Globetrotters, had a monopoly pretty much on all the black players. And there was an unwritten rule in the NBA amongst the owners. Again, basketball wasn't the major sport back then, so they didn't sell out. But the game that made the most money, that drew the most audience, were either games played against the Globetrotters or having the Globetrotters play as in an exhibition game, you know, as a doubleheader. So when Walter Brown selected my father back in 1950, my understanding, you know, they didn't have the sports radio stations, ESPN and that sort of thing, but they were in a smoke-filled hotel room. And Walter Brown said, you know,
owner of the Celtics,
and the 13th pick overall, first pick in the second round, said, I'll take Chuck Cooper out of Duquesne University. So one of the other owners said, you can't take him, he's colored. And Walter Brown said, I don't give a damn if he's straight, polka dot, or plaid. I take Charles Cooper out of Duquesne because he's the best player to help my franchise win right now. So the rest was sort of history. And Abe Saperstein and Globetrotters never played in the Boston Garden again. But, you know, sometime when you do the right thing, you're rewarded. And Walter Brown did the right thing. The Celtics did the right thing. And they went on that right now, they're probably arguably one of the most successful sports franchises in the history of sports. So sometime it does pay to do the right thing.
They created some good karma. And that was before they started. They've won more world championships than any other NBA team, but this is before the Celtics started winning those championships.
Well, they didn't start winning until Bill Russell got there. And my dad, he got a little frustrated. You know, even though he was the first African-American ball player, you know, he always told me that the NBA wasn't ready for any black stars. So he was expected to do the dirty work, rebound, play good defense. So he really get a chance to showcase his offensive talent. But if you go to our website, we have some video up there, and he's finger rolling, he's crossing over, he's touch passing. So, you know, I always thought Connie Hawkins was the first guy who really introduced a finger roll.
The former Pittsburgh Piper.
That's right. But we have some footage on our website that shows that there was some finger roll going on back in 1950.
Before Connie Hawkins.
Before Connie Hawkins.
Well, when your dad was drafted by the Celtics now in 1950, and let's go back to that story. You know, Walter Brown, as you mentioned, the NBA wasn't the moneymaker that it is today. Professional basketball, it had a strange evolution. There was a time when, you know, teams barnstormed and they'd play. There's an old term used to describe basketball players, cagers. And I used to wonder, where does that – why do they say that? And it turns out that they used to – in the early days, the 30s and 40s, professional basketball in some cases was played with a fence around the court, which means the ball never goes out of bounds and guys are smashing each other against the fence going for the ball.
I'm glad I didn't play that time.
Yeah, thus the name cager. So it evolves out of that. It's never really popular except with the Globetrotters, which they're still around today, but back then they're beating NBA teams. They're a huge draw. Saperstein's making money hand over fist, and he can – when he says to Walter Brown, if you draft Chuck Cooper, if you take Chuck Cooper away from me, I will never play in your arena again. I'll never play the Celtics again. That's a major stand that Walter Brown is taking.
Yeah, my dad always gave I grew up hearing Mr. Brown a great deal of credit. He always said he was a man with a great deal of intestinal fortitude and a tremendous backbone for taking that stand, because he actually was in financial he had some financial challenges at that time of the draft. So not only did he do the right thing, but he took a financial risk. And my father always appreciated him for, you know, being a man to step up and doing the right thing.
We've heard what Jackie Robinson went through when he joins the Dodgers, when he breaks the color line in Major League Baseball in 1947. Your dad, what did he have to go through when he was in the NBA in 1950?
Well, again, I think that's where he gave Jackie a lot of credit for making things easier. So it wasn't the first experience to American sports, having an African-American perform at a professional level or play at a professional level. But, and one of the differences, too, I think he got a little more support from his teammates than Jackie did. A lot of the basketball players back then were college educated. They went through college, so a little bit different when you look at the history of Major League Baseball back then. So, but he was supported for the most part. But certainly traveling, you know, you think about now, they bring in motivational speakers, you know, to talk about team unity, to pull teams together.
Well, they've got sports psychologists, yeah, psychologists and all that stuff.
All that stuff, and here he was. You know, the team would go eat dinner after the game, and he'd have to get a sandwich bag off the back door. He couldn't stay at the same hotel, you know, with his teammates. So what amazes me more than anything is how he was able to perform at a professional level going through all that, you know, behind the scenes. It just amazes me how he and all the other pioneers were able to deal with that and still perform at a professional level.
And this was, in addition to the risk that Walter Brown is taking by taking a player away from the Harlem Globetrotters, and I do want to get into that telegram that enables your when Abe Saperstein, he had to basically sign off on your dad going to the Celtics, but the Celtics were, you know, they're taking a stand. They are saying that we've seen integration in other areas, and this is before civil rights,
right?
So this was an important stand that the Celtics were taking, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, you hear a lot about Boston sometimes not being the most racially segregated city. But
most racially integrated city.
Integrated city, right. Thank you. But when you think about the Celtics, you know, they drafted my father as the first African-American, which officially brought the color barrier. They started the first black starting five. Bill Russell was the first major league head coach, African-American head coach. So, the Celtics continued to take a stand. And in recent years, you know, they were a franchise that had one of the few black coaches. They definitely took a stand.
And so they, of course, have to get him away from the Globetrotters. So describe, you know, your dad was what, under contract to the Globetrotters at that time?
He was on a contract with the Harlem Globetrotters. And in order for him to actually go and play with the Celtics, he had to be released. And we got a telegram that Western Union – it's funny now when you think about the way we communicate today. But it was a Western Union telegram telling him that he would release because of the historical significance of him becoming the first African-American ball player, that he would – and my dad – this is not in the telegram, but reluctantly released him from his contract, which enabled my father to go on and play for the Celtics.
When we talked about Jackie Robinson, he had what amounted to a handshake agreement with Branch Rickey, who ran the Dodgers, that he would not respond to any taunts or abuse from fans or players when he broke into Major League Baseball. Did your dad have any such agreement or arrangement with Red Auerbach, the legendary coach of the Celtics, or Walter Brown, for that matter, when he signed with the team?
I don't remember him saying that. I certainly haven't read that was the case. And if it was the case, he certainly didn't live up to it, because there were a few altercations that he experienced with some name calling, being a Pittsburgher and coming up and growing up in East Liberty, the old Larmer Avenue section of Pittsburgh. They didn't take too well from being called the N word, and my understanding was there was a situation where somebody called him the N word and he responded.
And looking back on his years with the Celtics, how did your dad feel about being a part of not any of the championship teams, but he played for Red Auerbach. He played with Bob Cousy. What was that like for him?
Well, he had a lot of respect for Red Auerbach. Bob Cousy was one of his best friends on the team, and oftentimes would hang out with my dad. They both loved jazz. And my dad would take Bob Cousy uptown, when he couldn't hang with the rest of the team, depending on where they were at. So he had a lot of respect for Red Auerbach and Bob Cousy and the whole Celtic organization.
Did your dad ever talk about wishing that he'd come along just a little bit later to be a part of the dynasties?
Well, he did because, again, he got a little frustrated because he was being forced to do the dirty work and not able to really play his game. So he got to the point where he wanted to leave Boston. So he pretty much asked for a trade, and he always joked around with me and told me, he said if he'd have knew Bill Russell was coming, he probably would have stuck around. So he missed out. Boston didn't start winning until the great Bill Russell got there.
And did he ever talk about the
winning championships? I should say they when my dad got there, he and Cousy, they actually start making the playoffs. So I just want to make sure I clear that up. But they didn't start winning championships until the great Mr. Russell got there.
Right. I think 57 was the first one, and that was after your dad had left. But did he ever talk about how the fans? Boston has a strange history with race. It's where the abolitionist movement flourished during the days of slavery. And yet, you look back on the chapters when Boston was trying to integrate schools. The Red Sox were, you talk about integration in baseball. They were the last team to take an African-American player onto their roster. And yet here were the Celtics being the opposite of that. How were the fans at the old Boston Garden?
I don't recall him telling me that he experienced a whole lot of negativity from the Boston fans. I'm sure there was some because, it was 1950. It was early 1950s.
Sure.
But I don't remember that being something that he talked a lot about, having really bad experiences with the Boston fans.
We're talking with Chuck Cooper III here on Essential Pittsburgh. His dad, Chuck Cooper, Pittsburgh native, became the first African-American player drafted by an NBA team. And another first for your dad was becoming the city of Pittsburgh's first African-American department head. He was named to lead the city's Parks and Recreation Department in 1970. What did that mean to him?
I think it meant a lot to him. And that was certainly he was appointed by then Mayor Pete Flaherty. It was tough back then for the family. When he got that position, that came gift wrapped with death threats. We got some phone calls to the house that my mother, we were just talking about that not too long ago, that experience.
I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but for some reason I am. This is 1970.
Right.
What was the problem people had? Black?
That was a big position. Government jobs back then were some of the better positions that you could have So just the fact that it was another barrier being broken,
Wow, incredible. And so you said phone calls came to the house?
Yeah, we've got a few phone calls came in, some death threats and that sort of thing. And, it was unfortunate. But, he was just a trailblazer. And a lot of his close friends think that, that kind of led to his early death. He just always lived in that stressful environment, carrying the weight of African Americans on his back, trying to do the best that he could so that other people would have opportunity to follow.
Your dad died, I believe it was 1984?
84, February 5th on a Sunday. I remember like it was yesterday.
And he was only, 57?
57
years old.
Right.
Well, let's end this on an upbeat note and talk about the events that are taking place in your dad's honor this week.
Yeah, well, we established the Chuck Cooper Foundation through Duquesne University. Actually, we started with the Chuck Cooper Classic basketball game. And I remember I got a call from Bill Nunn, the great scout of the Steelers, and said that Tom Rooney, one of the Rooneys, was trying to get in touch with me. When I finally talked to Tom, he let me know that Duquesne University was really interested in doing this classic. And PNC was the sponsor. Well, my dad worked for Pittsburgh National Bank, so I started thinking about it. I said, wait a minute, you got a Rooney involved, one of the members of the first family of Pittsburgh. Duquesne University, my dad's alma mater that he truly loved, and PNC, which was his favorite employer when it was Pittsburgh National Bank, it was a no-brainer to do it. So, you know, once that got off the ground, you know, I was able to establish the Chuck Cooper Foundation, also with the support of PNC. And through the foundation, you know, we want to continue my father's legacy of giving back in community service. And a lot of people don't know that my father got his master's degree from the University of Minnesota after he retired from professional basketball. So we thought a nice niche would be is to celebrate, you know, his legacy and give graduate-level scholarships. And right now we're up to $64,000, and we've been able to give support to 18 students.
And so there's the big game to wrap up this week on Saturday.
Duquesne versus Dayton, and our luncheon is actually tomorrow, and we're honoring Schwinn Cash with the Chuck Cooper Leadership Diversity and Community Service Award. Not just, you know, she's a tremendous basketball player, but she's also a tremendous person. And what she does in the community is just extraordinary. So we're definitely giving her, looking forward to honoring her tomorrow with the Chuck Cooper Award. It should be a fantastic event. I mean, our sponsors have came through big time for us, Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, Highmark, UPMC Health Plan. And through our sponsors, you know, we're able to raise the money, recognize those kids and invest in their educations, and also recognize great people like Schwinn Cash.
Well, it's a wonderful legacy of athleticism, courage, and leadership on the part of your dad, Chuck Cooper, that's being remembered this week. And we've been talking with Chuck Cooper's son, Chuck Cooper III, here on Essential Pittsburgh. It's been a pleasure meeting you.
It's my pleasure, Paul. My pleasure.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Coming up, how has the reporting of unemployment numbers changed? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.